Word on Today FM.
John Gibbons is with us for the last word in the environment. Tell us a little bit about the increased carbon emissions which are being attributed to the growth of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, good evening, Matt. I suppose, obviously, AI is it's pretty much here, there and it's everywhere. And we might expect an increase in emissions arising from this because, obviously, AI and these so-called large language models, that they're incredibly computational intense. And I mean, this is on multiples of scales above the, for example, traditionally you had your Google search and that took a certain amount of energy. Now, the equivalent AI query on that uses on average about 10 times more energy.
I think it could be more than 20 times.
It could be more. Now, however, before we even get to that, the compilation of these so-called large language models, I'll give you an example, Matt. They reckon that the AI, the emissions connected to these large systems and the highest emitting systems, take ChatGPT, for example, we're looking at individual systems potentially producing over 100 million tons of CO2 equivalent per annum. Now, for context, the entire emissions of Ireland is about 60 million tons. So we're talking about individual large language AI systems using a lot more energy in a year, and more emissions, Matt, in a year than the Republic of Ireland. That'll give you an idea of the scale of pollution that we're talking about here. And of course, they'll tell you in the press release, oh, sure, we're renewable energy this and renewable energy that. As we've seen in Ireland and elsewhere, what we're doing, in fact, is many of the data centres that are supporting this rapid expansion, if you check alongside them, they have banks of gigantic diesel engines as well as
That's backup, which they may not necessarily be using. Many of the wind farms that have been built around Ireland have been paid for by these tech companies.
Sure, I agree.
And they wouldn't have been built otherwise.
Well, I suppose if there's a commercial model there to build wind farms, they should be built. But nobody, and I mean nobody, gets a free pass here. But imagine 100 million tons of emissions that weren't there, by the way, 5 years ago.
So what's your solution? That we decide we don't want artificial intelligence because it's too energy consuming?
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, as with so many of these things, like there's good and bad with artificial intelligence, as we know. And I don't think we could spend the rest of the slot debating those. I think what we need to look at here is, do we set limits on these? For example, in other areas, whether it's aviation aviation's a bad example, but in many other areas of life, we're trying to ratchet down carbon emissions drastically because we know what the alternative to that is and the consequences. The issue here is, this is all brand new, Matt. It's sort of rushed through. There's at the moment, there's an absolute bonanza environment. We've got these companies, one of them the other day was valued at $500 billion. This is a company that has done nothing but lose money.
Okay, but hang on, let's talk practically here. I mean, you could, for example, argue that if you were to apply artificial intelligence to air traffic control, you could reduce emissions 20-25% because you would route the planes better and you would get them between a starting point and end destination a lot more quickly, burning an awful lot less fuel. That's just one example. But let's take it for people's personal behaviour. If you decide you want to know something, are you saying instead of using ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude or whatever is your preference to search something, that you should go for an old-fashioned, shall we say, Google search, which may take you longer on the basis that it uses less energy?
I suppose, look, if people are confronted, especially when it's now been installed as the default, you go onto a browser and Google will immediately churn you up AI results. So I don't expect individuals to make that choice. I mean, as ever, Matt, nobody here is arguing for the legislation or regulation of individuals. What we need to look at instead is, there's an enormous carbon impact from this sector. It needs to own that. It needs to stop ducking it. It needs to own it. It needs to be managed. And we have to set limits because we're operating within global carbon limits. And for the record, that means we're operating within the Paris Agreement, Matt, 2015, which says all of us in every sector in the world, we need to be striving to keep global temperatures below 1.5. And as we're seeing, we're absolutely failing in that.
Okay, but then what about July just gone, been cooler than 2023?
Sure. This again is the Copernicus report out this week. 2023, Matt, and 2024 were simply off the charts. They were hyper anomalous. Now, what we see in 2025 is we're still way above pre-industrial, about 1.25 degrees above. It just happened in the last 2 years to have spiked up to over 1.5 degrees above. So what we see in this, as we've always said, within the climate system, you have bumpiness. From year to year, and from month to month and season to season, you're going to get bumps and anomalies. You'll have, for example, La Nina effect, El Nino effect. And I suppose the job of science is to sift through the noise, the data noise, Matt, like this, and to look instead at the trend line. So what we can say for sure that is different between, say, now and when we had this conversation 12 months ago is there's about another 50 billion tonnes of long-acting carbon emissions in the global atmosphere. Now, that plays itself out in different ways. For example, some years the global oceans draw down more heat, other years they release more heat. So there's lots of variability within the system, but the trend line is absolutely clear and it is trending upwards. So nothing, unfortunately, has changed in that regard. We see, for example, Matt, some of this additional energy, you might be asking me, where is it going? Where it's going is it's heating the top 2 metres of the world's oceans. We're seeing absolute anomalies in temperatures. And for example, you may have spotted that in Finland, and I think you referred to it, in fact, in the news bulletin at 5 o'clock. We had a whole streak of days above 30 degrees centigrade. And just to remind your listeners, Finland, we're talking about areas inside the Arctic Circle above 30 degrees centigrade. And if this were just happening in Finland, I could say to you, that's a regional anomaly. But for example, in Canada at the moment, the forest fires are so massive. We're looking at about 16 million acres burning, Matt. They reckon it's the equivalent in parts of Canada of smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. The air quality is that extreme. And we're seeing this, the northern hemisphere, the southern hemisphere, east, west, wherever you go. And that's really what tells us that this is a global issue.
Let's move on to something else. When you were growing up in Kilkenny, did you ever go out shooting on the farm?
Guilty as charged, yeah. Pretty much if it moved, I would have had a shot at it, yeah.
Shotgun
mostly, also a 2.2 rifle. Which is the low caliber rifle. So a combination of those, shotgun usually for blasting things in trees and stuff like that.
The shotgun, of course, works on the basis of lead pellets, doesn't it?
That's right. Your typical shotgun cartridge has around 100, maybe 150 tiny lead pellets in it. And so every time you crack off a round of that, you basically shower those lead pellets into the environment and they end up absolutely everywhere. And to give you an example of or a sense of how incredibly the numbers we're talking here, Matt, it's reckoned across the EU about 100,000 tonnes of waste lead from shooting is dispersed into the environment across the EU every year. Now, a couple of years ago...
What damage does that do?
Well, first of all, obviously, if you're in the direct path of it, you get direct lead poisoning. But there's indirect lead poisoning as well. They find, for example, that waterfowl, water birds, they tend to eat... They pick up the lead pellets because they look like food pellets to them. Also, these birds use grit for their gizzards as part of their digestion. When they ingest lead and it hits their stomach acid, the lead basically bubbles off and the birds get lead poisoning. For severe lead poisoning, they die. But many of them actually suffer from brain damage and from behavioural effects from lead poisoning. Now, it's reckoned that we're looking at, say in Britain alone, between 50,000 and 100,000 birds dying that were not shot directly, but that died as a result of lead poisoning. When you scale that across the EU...
Every year.
And not that. When you scale that, Matt, across the EU, we're talking millions of birds. So these are birds that were not shot. And for example, you might say, raptors like eagles and buzzards, they tend to scavenge on prey. So they will often eat the carcasses of animals that have been shot. And in so doing, they ingest the lead and they in turn get lead poisoning. So when you're randomly dumping lead into the atmosphere or into the environment, I should say, like this, these are the consequences. Now, as I said, a couple of years ago, the EU brought in a regulation to restrict the use of lead rounds in proximity to wetlands. Now, countries that had more than 20% of their area of wetlands were allowed a complete lead ban. Ireland turns out to have 18.72%. So on the basis of that, the department in Ireland said, no, we're not going to introduce a lead ban. So we're still allowing this lead rounds to be fired into the environment. Now, you might say, well, they're not firing it in wetlands. Who on earth is out checking individuals with their shotguns as to whether they're in wetlands or drylands? So the only solution to this, Matt, is a full ban on lead shot right across the EU of all kinds.
And they just brought in the ban in the UK. What's the situation in Ireland?
Yeah, the situation in Ireland is that theoretically you're not supposed to use lead rounds in the proximity of wetlands. The reality is that is impossible to enforce. The only way to enforce this is an outright ban.
One other thing, we've run way over time, but let's not worry about that. What have you got against the cherry laurel?
Yes, indeed. Well, it's, you know, we live and learn, right? Up until a few days ago, I had nothing against the cherry laurel, but I was along at an Irish Wildlife Trust conference the other evening, and one of their speakers explained that the cherry laurel, which, by the way, we grow 100 hectares of it commercially here in Ireland for export. It's promoted, for example, by Chagas as a commercial crop. In fact, it's a particularly noxious, invasive species. And for example, the part of the damage it does is that its leaves are infused with a cyanide-based chemicals that essentially poison the ground underneath them. And also, of course, cherry laurel is such an intense predator, if you like, or invasive species, that nothing else grows where cherry laurel grows. But the strange thing is, Matt, you could go home this evening, go to your local store, whether garden centre or store, and buy a cherry laurel plant for a fiver or 10 euros. So we have this really strange anomaly, for example, that Quilcha, over the last 3 years, has spent €500,000 trying to remove cherry laurel because it's such a noxious, pernicious predator or invader. For example, everybody in Ireland knows that the rhododendron, which is an invasive species in Ireland, is out of control. But what we're seeing as well is we have special area of conservation habitats, Hazelwood in Sligo, Coolgarry Land, Massey Wood, the Devil's Glen in Wicklow, all of these overrun with cherry laurel. So we have an extraordinary situation, Matt, that in Ireland, this species, which is designated, for example, by the National Biodiversity Data Centre and the Parks and Wildlife Service as an invasive species, yet it's completely legal to plant this thing and it escapes everywhere.
Actually, I was down in Killarney about a month ago and talking to somebody about the rhododendron. They said that the Park Service now seems confident that it has found a way of extracting it without spreading it. I must look into that, find out about it, that there are improvements have been made in trying to get rid of it.
It's tough. I mean, getting rid of rhododendron, I mean, these invasive species are incredibly fertile and remarkably good at spreading themselves. Rhododendron can be dealt with. It needs to be extracted carefully, but it also, you have to poison the roots of it to take it out. And so localized, selective, highly selective herbicide is totally justified when it comes to removing invaders like that.
There are times when you'll allow for things that.
Definitely, Matt. In the right time and the right place.
John Givens, as ever, thank you.
The Last Word on Today FM.